Now, I understood you when you rang up a year or so ago, Michael, to ask me to speak, as inviting me to speak as the third of three speakers who were to speak about the Christian Trinity.
Oh, well, I don't remember that.
And I understood that the first speaker was to be David Black, and then a David Cox, and then a David Holt. I certainly got the impression that I was supposed to represent the third person of the Trinity. And to try to speak of Jung's work from that point of view. And that was the idea which lodged itself in my mind, whether it was my own wish or yours, and has seeded my thinking, with what result we shall now hear. In my understanding, the third person of the Trinity moves between the Father and the Son in ways which are controversial to humans. I also understand it to be prophetic of what is to come as fulfillment of what has been done. So I want to try and speak of Jung's work from a position which allows of movement between Father and Son, and for prophecy. And I shall speak to two themes. The first is Jung's distinction between extroversion and introversion. I shall try to give some idea how this distinction moves me, and I shall try to sound chords which are personal, mystical, and social. My second theme is Jung's attitude to time. I shall propose that Jung's psychology assumes two views of time, and that there's need for work in bringing them together. And I shall speak of that work as a remembering of the createdness of time. And in doing so, I will allow a certain hesitant note of prophecy to sound in my voice. And together, I hope these two themes will leave us with a lively sense of unfinished business with a number three. For that, if I were now to have the choosing of my own a title, would be what I would like to call this talk, Unfinished Business with a Number Three. So I start with extroversion and introversion. Jung's book on psychological types was one of the first of his which I read while a student. I remember how excited I was with the historical chapters, how much the extrovert-introvert distinction seemed able to explain in the history of thought and argument. But it remained outside me a concept which I could use as I wished, not a reality in which I dwelt. During the last 10, 12 years or so, it has taken me over in a new way, this distinction between extroversion and introversion. I think of various moments when I've become seized of the extrovert-introvert distinction in ways which I cannot now renounce. I want to mention some of them in an attempt to strengthen understanding of what is at stake between extrovert and introvert. The first was in conjunction with the word honor, or rather its negation, dishonor. Someone was talking in desperation of an acquaintance who seemed to undermine and undo her every time they met in ways which seemed so slight as to be ridiculous, unworthy of attention. Choice of words, a gesture, the manner of listening. It was ridiculous to make such a fuss over. I know she means well. I know it's my doing as well as hers. And yet, this in a voice of desperation. It's as if she dishonors me. Over months, we came to use Jung's distinction between extrovert and introvert to explore what was happening in this experience of being dishonored. It served as a reliable compass in what was for both of us a voyage of discovery. Yet for me, something was missing. The word dishonor hung in the air, witness to some sense of violation which I couldn't associate with those ugly Latinate words, extroversion and introversion. I'd come at that time to imagine the movement, alternation between extroversion and introversion, in terms of the center and circumference of a circle. It seemed to me that within the extrovert mode of being, we feared introversion as if it could lead to the draining away of everything through a sort of plug hole at the center of the world. While for the introvert, extroversion was feared as if it could lead to the loss of meaning through a sort of centrifugal evacuation of the world, everything flying off and being lost and scattered over the borders of the circumference. What did such an alternation between center and circumference have to do with honor and dishonor? And the answer, the beginnings of an answer, came to me in the language of mysticism. The moment in which I came to recognize how this sort of alternation could represent something beyond itself, something which might account for the desperation and desolation and dishonor which can be experienced in personal encounter between extrovert and introvert, was in reading Gershom Scholem's book on Jewish mysticism. I don't know if I can even begin to convey how this happened, since the particular moment was carried within a slow, over weeks, reading of the book, a slow and gradual becoming acquainted with a mystical tradition of which I knew nothing. For those of you who have the book at home, it was in the reading of pages 260 to 262 that I now locate this moment when my understanding of extroversion and introversion altered. In the seventh lecture, the lecture on Isaac Luria, and his school of Kabbalah. Scholem is describing how Luria speaks of God's act of creation and is contrasting it with the older Kabbalists who saw God's original act as his projection of his creative power out of his own self. Every new act following on that origin for them was a further stage in the process of externalization, which unfurls in a straight line from above downwards. Uriah's teaching, on the other hand, has, in Scholem's words, nothing of this inoffensive simplicity. He begins, and here I'm going to quote Scholem directly, by putting a question which gives the appearance of being very naturalistic and, if you like, somewhat cruel. How can there be a world if God is everywhere? If God is all in all, how can there be things which are not God? How can God create the world out of nothing if there is no nothing? And the solution became, in spite of the crude form which he gave it, of the highest importance in the history of later Kabbalistic thought. According to Lira, God was compelled to make room for the world by, as it were, abandoning a region within himself, a kind of mystical primordial space from which he withdrew in order to return to it in the act of creation and revelation. So the first act of all is not an act of revelation, but one of limitation. More than that, every new act of emanation and manifestation is preceded by one of concentration and retraction. Every stage in the cosmic process involves a double strain, i.e. the light which streams back into God and that which flows out from him. And but for this perpetual tension, this ever-repeated effort with which God holds himself back, nothing in the world would exist. Those are extracts from the pages which themselves were read and gradually assimilated and understood in the context of the whole book. But there are extracts from a reading which transfigured my understanding of why the difference between extrovert and introvert can matter so very much. If the talk of inside and outside, of subject and object, which we use in expressing that difference, refers not only to the relation between persons and bodies in space, but also to the act which sustains space itself, then that experience of dishonor, of having the ground pulled from under your feet, of being threatened by something almost like metaphysical annihilation sometimes, which characterizes some of the close encounters between extrovert and introvert, was suddenly seen in a new light. For what was at stake was no longer just a difference in psychological type, but a difference in how we attend to the presence of God. Once given, this conviction hasn't left me, that the psychology of extroversion and introversion is grounded in ontology, in how we attend to being, in how we worship God. And if you say, as has been said to me, that the word ontology is not to be found in Jung's psychological types, or perhaps in his work as a whole, do read again the historical chapters of psychological types and think what they're about. They are integral to the book and essential to an understanding of the 10th chapter in which the types are described. But what I miss in Jung and in the kind of mystical tradition out of which Scholem writes is any sustained interest in exploring the social implications and expressions of extroverted and introverted encounter and antagonism. Jung draws extensively on traditions which see the human body as microcosm to the macrocosm of the universe. I am interested in a middle world between the two, in analyzing the ways in which society, the social body, mediates between individual and cosmos, cosmos and individual. This, for me, is one place where the spirit moves in power. For instance, in relation to symbols, the theme of man and his symbols is a leitmotif of Jung's work. How do we relate his archetypal understanding of symbols to the structural analysis of symbolic form and action which the social anthropologists are giving us? There's a whole world to be explored here, a world which reveals itself to discovery from many directions. This pervading metaphor of insides and outsides features prominently in the language of various schools of workers, and I would like to see Jung's distinction between extroversion and introversion open into wider engagement between individual and social experience of the symbolic life. For instance, a book which has influenced me deeply over the last 10 years and inspired me to reflect in new ways on man and his symbols has been Mary Douglas's Natural Symbols. Her chapter on the two bodies, the physical and social, is full of new interior perspectives on why the difference between inside and outside can matter so very much. it moves my spirit to hazard new translations between psychoanalytic and anthropological understanding of incarnation, of what it is like to be in a body. The last sentences of the chapter on the two bodies have become for me a sort of text to be almost chanted at times, almost a sort of creed or creedal statement. And though it's unfair both on you and on Mary Douglas to quote them out of context, I shall do so. The physical body can have universal meaning, and that is what is said in the microcosm traditions to which Jung refers us so often. The physical body can have universal meaning only as a system which responds to the social system. What it symbolizes naturally is the relation of parts of an organism to the whole. Natural symbols can express the relation of an individual to his society at that general systemic level. The two bodies are the self and society. Sometimes they are so near as to be almost merged. Sometimes they are far apart. The tension between them allows the elaboration of meaning. I have known someone to be held together in a field of seemingly intolerable conflict by the comfort of that last sentence. The tension between them allows the elaboration of meaning. Between self and society, the fields of symbolization are richer and more varied than we can imagine, because what is at stake is the creation of cosmos. But the symbols which move us between microcosm and macrocosm are always and essentially social. There will always be more at stake in the encounter between extrovert and introvert than we expect, because what is being hazarded in that encounter is creation, creation that is personal, mystical, and social. Those are some reflections on extroversion and introversion. Now I would like to move on to my second theme, Jung and time. In Jung's work, two different philosophies of time exist side by side. He doesn't seem to have been uncomfortable with their coexistence. But I think it's left to others to find how they do coexist in his work. One of the main arguments I want to advance this evening is that the difference between these two views of time is one of Jung's most valuable legacies to us. But if we are to inherit it, we must first recognize it for what it is, a legacy of unfinished business. On the one hand, Jung seems to have subscribed what I would like to call a Darwinian belief in evolutionary time. Such time is absolutely disproportionate to the lifetime of a human being. Compared to a person's lifetime, it is without beginning and without end, a wholly impersonal continuum in which the present is all but lost between the vastness of before and after. And on the other hand, we have all those insights of a very different kind, which he gathered together around the concept of synchronicity. I believe that one of the more urgent tasks facing students of Jung is to recognize how different these two philosophies of time are, to admit it among ourselves, to proclaim it, and to research into it. If we can do that, then the spirit of Jung's psychology and the spirit of our times will cooperate in new ways. I'm not going to develop the argument through a close study of Jung's work this evening. That needs doing, but this is not the occasion. Instead, I feel that I'm allowed, by the gift of your title, to speak with a certain hesitant note of prophecy. And I want to speak, therefore, of the createdness of time. I believe the Spirit is calling us today to remember the createdness of time. The call is heard in many places. One is from within Jung's work in the dissonance between his varying assumptions as to the nature of time. But it is also to be heard in many other places. What I want to try to do now is to sound that call in a way which will move us between our interest in Jung's work and some of those other places where the creativeness of time is demanding and receiving attention. How do we imagine the creativeness of time? I shall take as my way into this question a myth which Jung might well have included in his amplification of pre-Christian Trinitarian motifs in his essay on the Trinity. And that is the Greek myth of the procession from father Cronos to son Zeus. Expect this story is familiar to some of you, but not to others. I want to present it within the context of social anthropology by referring to a short, remarkable essay by Edmund Leach on the symbolic representation of time. In this essay, which is called Chronos and Chronos, Chronos being the name of the god and Chronos being the Greek word for time, Leach considers one of the most puzzling characters in classical Greek mythology, that of Chronos, father of Zeus. And he asks, why was Chronos, this god, taken as a symbolic representation of Chronos, eternal time? Etymologically, there's no close connection between the two words, which I try and indicate by my pronunciation is spelled differently. Yet from the very early days of Greek philosophical reflection on the nature of time, the play between these light-sounding words was taken to both express and conceal a major issue of theology. Why? Nietzsche's answer is both simple and very odd. And when I first came across it, I found it strangely familiar, as if I'd known it all along, and yet absolutely surprising, almost shocking. It is that human interest in sexuality and death, and in how they may be related, creates time. His argument is so concise, so dense, that it ought to be read in its entirety. I won't try to condense it. All I can hope to do is to give you a taste of what Leach believes to be at stake in the procession from father Cronos to son Zeus. And here is his summary of the myth. Cronos, king of the Titans, was the son of Uranus, the sky, and Gea, the earth. As the children of Uranus were born, Uranus pushed them back again into the body of Gea. Gea, to escape this prolonged pregnancy, armed Cronos with a sickle with which he castrated his father. The blood from the bleeding phallus fell into the sea, and from the foam was born Aphrodite. Cronos then begat children by his sister Rhea. As they were born, he swallowed them. When the youngest, Zeus, was born, Rhea deceived Cronos by giving him a phallic stone wrapped in a cloth instead of the newborn infant to swallow. Zeus thus grew up. When Zeus was adult, Cronos vomited up his swallowed children, namely Hades, Poseidon, Hestia, Hera, Demeter, and also the stone phallus, which last became a cult object at Delphi. Zeus now rebelled against King Cronos and overthrew him. According to one version, he castrated him. Placed in restraint, Cronos became nevertheless the beneficent ruler of the Elysian fields, home of the blessed dead. It's a very matter-of-fact summary of a gruesome story. What can these bloody images of childbirth and castration have to say about the createdness of time? What does this confusion, this polymorphous confusion of mouth and vagina, womb and stomach, strangely disturbing as it is to our sense of what passes between the inside and outside of bodies, what does it have to say about the beginning and ending of time? Leach's answer draws on an enviably wide field of anthropological research. He's interested in the structure of the myth, and in particular in the image of oscillation. The out-in, out-in, out-in oscillation, as the children of Uranus are born and shoved back in again. Similar out-in, out-in, as the children of Cronus are born and then swallowed. The reversal to an in-out as the swallowed children of Cronus are vomited up. Leach bids us attend to this oscillation, and in particular to the function of the intervening third, which breaks the beat, the castrating sickle, the swallowed stone, for an understanding of how and why the myth tells of the creation of time. He reminds us of societies existing today in which time is not experienced as a going on and on in the same direction, or round and round at the same wheel, but as something discontinuous, a repetition of repeated reversal, a sequence of oscillations between polar opposites, night and day, winter and summer, drought and flood, age and youth, life and death. That is the first point to grasp. Instead of thinking of time as flow, whether in a line or circle or spiral, imagine it as oscillation, rhythm, beat. Let me repeat the crucial phrase. Something discontinuous, a repetition of repeated reversal. Musicians usually know what is being said here. Think of it musically, especially if you can imagine having the composing, conducting, rehearsing, and performing of your own set piece. Leach then goes on to show how the notion that the time process is an oscillation between opposites, between day and night, or between life and death, implies the existence of a third entity, the thing that oscillates, the I that is at one moment in the daylight and at another in the dark, the soul that is at one moment in the living body and at another in the tomb. It is at this stage of the argument that the relation between sexuality and death emerges as crucial for how we understand the createdness of time. Something is being said, it seems to me, when I'm in the right mood, which is extraordinarily exciting in relation to what we think of, or used to think of, as the Freud-Jung split in the history of psychoanalysis, and also in relation to the wider encounter between psychoanalytic and biological understanding of sexuality and death. It is this, that what makes time both go on and also repeat reversal is human owning of an analogy between sexuality and death. As Leach puts it in relation to this story, when the Greeks conceived the oscillations of time by analogy with the oscillations of the soul, they were using a concrete metaphor. Basically, it is the metaphor of sexual coitus, of the ebb and flow of the sexual essence between sky and earth, with the rain of semen, between this world and the underworld, with marrow fat and vegetable seeds as semen, between man and woman. In short, it is the sexual act itself which provides the primary image of time. But this is necessarily related to dying. In the act of copulation, the male imparts a bit of his life soul to the female. In giving birth, she yields it forth again. Coitus is here seen as a kind of dying for the male, giving birth as a kind of dying for the female. So, the third, which has to be, if there is to be oscillation between opposites. When humanity owns this third, then time can both go on and repeat reversal. And by own, I mean an activity which both claims and confesses, both claims an ownership, as it were, and also admits, confesses something. Now, if we're to take Leach's point, we must realize that what he's saying is incomprehensible from within a view of time as given in nature. What is at stake in any attempt to remember the createdness of time is a break with nature. An assumption is being made which is not and can never be reasonable, if by reasonable we mean natural. But it is reasonable if we are willing to invoke an authority which is over nature. And this is what we do when we take it on ourselves both to claim and to confess an analogy between sexuality and death in order that time may go on and repeat reversal. I want to try to illustrate what I mean by taking two themes out of my own practice, themes which will, I believe, be familiar to most of us. The first is our interest in family trees, in genealogy, in what passes or happens between the generations. The second is our nightmares of doomsday. Can these help us imagine what it's like both to claim and to confess an analogy between sexuality and death in order that time may go on and repeat reversal? If I've worked these figures out accurately, they represent the biological ancestry of my son, giving the approximate numbers at the turn of each century between now and the Norman Conquest, and assuming three generations to each century. Now, I first saw figures like these some years ago when Alistair Harvey was lecturing on what I think he called the gene pool, the pool of genetic inheritance which we all share and on which we all draw. Since then, I found myself returning to them again and again in a sort of wondering meditation. What is it that they are saying to me? Now, this figure down here of over 1,000 million certainly does not refer to actual men and women. The entire population of the world then was probably about a quarter of that figure. Many hundreds of thousands of them were in fact the same, a reminder of the complex structure of cross-cousin marriage by which our seemingly exogamous choices of husband and wife are in fact sustained. So we have to ask ourselves, as my younger son reminded me when he loaned me his calculator to work out the figures the other day, well, how many ancestors did I really have at the Norman Conquest study? I think what these figures are saying is that there's a difference between the sort of time assumed in our search for biological ancestry and the time of history. The time of family tree and the time of history are not real in the same sense. They cannot be measured for the same scale. So where is the break between this lot of figures, as it were, this lot, and what the, and the time scales are measuring? Where does the break occur? Does it occur somewhere about here, where most of us who've had any success in tracing our ancestry begin to find it fades out completely? Or earlier, somewhere down here, like it, say about here at the time of the Black Death, when these figures are becoming, frankly, unimaginable? I don't think so. I think the break between the two ways of measuring time occurs right here, at the beginning, or is it the end? Between the last, or is it the first child, and the last, or are they the first parents? The time of biology and the time of history intersect and separate in family between the generations, between the sexes, and an exchange or oscillation between two requires the presence of a third. Whether or not you accept my suggested answer, I do recommend these figures for reflective meditation. You will, I believe, find that they move one's imagination in unexpected ways. For instance, what Freud has taught us to call the Oedipus complex begins to sound very different when we allow that the time of biology and the time of history may not be the same. To me, reflecting on these figures and other things too, the Oedipus the complex begins to sound like a call to remember that time is not given in nature, but assumes authority over nature. Or consider Jung's idea of the collective unconscious and the entirely unresolved problem of how to relate it, on the one hand, to evolutionary genetics, and on the other hand, to a social environment. Does it help us if we question not only Jung's assumptions about time, but also those of evolutionary theory? Listen to this extract about the inventiveness of sexuality and death, from a book by François Jacob, a distinguished French geneticist, called The Logic of Living Systems. The notion that evolution results exclusively from a succession of micro-events from mutations each occurring at random is denied both by time and arithmetic. For the wheel of chance to come up step by step, subunit after subunit, with each of the several 10,000 protein chains needed to compose the body of a mammal, would require far more time than the span generally attributed to the solar system. Evolution has become possible only because genetic systems have themselves evolved. As organisms become more complicated, their reproduction also becomes more complicated. A whole series of mechanisms appears, and he lists them. But the most important inventions are sex and death. Death not from without as the result of some accident, but death imposed from within as a necessity prescribed from the egg onward by the genetic program itself. Invention. Sexuality and death as inventions. What is this power to invent suddenly moves between chance and necessity in this neo-Darwinian vision of how time and life are related? Could it be in any way connected to the imaginal resourcefulness of our dreams, to that resourcefulness which appears to be both original for the very first time and also very old? If it were, then I think the call to remember the creativeness of time may be sounding more insistently than we've yet realized. But this call does not come only from our interest in the past, in family tree, genealogy, evolution. It comes also, and for some much more urgently, from the future. In prophecies of doomsday, the doomsday of technological waste or nuclear apocalypse, many are deeply troubled by such visions, and there are times when I have counted myself among them. Yet I've come to believe that much of this anxiety is not so much about the future as about the nature of time itself. I'm constantly reminded in my work of the psychoanalytic warning that in the fear there may be hidden the unacknowledged wish. And I've asked myself, what conceivable wish could be hidden in our fears of nuclear holocaust? And the only answer that makes any kind of sense to me is that we may be getting desperate in our wish to remember for ourselves how time is created. So let me conclude with three different responses to the fear of doomsday, each of which is, I believe, evidence of a call to remember the createdness of time. I will leave them to speak for themselves, asking only that you allow them their hesitant prophetic note. The first is a dream of my own from 1957, at a time when the great powers were still exploding test bombs in the atmosphere. I and others are waiting in London for a possible end of the world air raid just before dawn. We are afraid. It's not a fear of death, but of change of state. The terror that somewhere they, the lords who control our fate, may already have dispatched the weapon that will destroy us and make us something else. I ask others how it will feel to live with our senses in Einstein's space-time. How shall we ever be able to understand the normal, necessary space-time of our pre-war world? I'm told that selected people are being trained for this. Then I find myself at the heart of our country's defense. But it's rather like the First World War cabinet with the Welshman Lloyd George as Prime Minister. There's a feeling of being at the center of whatever plans are being made to restore continuity after the devastation. And it's announced in awed secrecy that of 800 volunteers who've been given the disease, which is something like radiation, with which we're all threatened, only 730 odd took. This means that some of us will not change state. There is statistical certainty of biological continuity for mankind, while the individual remains almost wholly at risk. It is said in the dream that this is an evolutionary development of a kind comparable with forgotten mutations in the limbo of archaeological and geological time. The second is from a book called The Conquest of Nature. It was written some 20 years ago, in the early years of the worldwide growing political debate about technology and its consequences. The author takes as his theme words of the then Secretary General to the United Nations, U Thant, that it is no longer resources that limit decisions, it is the decision that makes the resources. This is the fundamental revolutionary change, perhaps the most revolutionary mankind has ever known. And he argues over a wide field against the prophets of doomsday. But it is the surprising last four words of the book which I want to quote, with their quiet suggestion that what is feared as still to come has already been done, if only we can remember. Here are the closing sentences of the book in order to place the last four words. The Indians on the west coast of South America tell a folk tale which must be very old, since the scene it describes is depicted on a pottery vase some 1400 years old. The story runs, this has happened and it will happen again. Long, long ago, the sun disappeared and the world was shrouded in complete darkness for 5 long days. This was the signal for the things to mobilize. Stones began to grind, the mortars and pestles marched against their masters, and even the llamas attacked their keepers in the stables. In our time, there's a tendency to catch sight of that same frightening vision, to blame our tools for showing malice because our world has gone wrong in so many ways. It's tempting to sit in the midst of the strange and wonderful array of our modern technology and cry out with a sorcerer's apprentice, how can I get rid of the spirits I've called up? The question is whether we, who have dominion over the earth, shall act like Sisyphus and trust to our cunning only, becoming more and more self-reliant and self-involved, self-imprisoned and self-centered. Sisyphus became his own god and his own Satan, at war with heaven, embittered with earth and contemptuous of hell. But this author, after contemplating 3/4 of a century of technology's marvels and horrors, has no doubt that Sisyphus has already been saved from himself. This happened at Easter. And my third is from a recent Quaker meeting in the United States. I have this account only at second hand, and it may be that error has entered into it and the event has been altered in the telling. The story I heard was of a meeting being held in the shadow of a particular expression of fear and resolution in the face of nuclear weapons. And there had been a long silence, over an hour by the clock, when an old woman spoke. And she said that she was 80-odd, and that for 50 years she'd been in the peace movement. And the world now, when she looked back on those 50 years, seemed to be a worse, much worse place than it had been 50 years ago. And she wondered whether it had all been worthwhile. And then she remembered a poem by the Irish poet James Stephen. She said that she couldn't remember it very well because she was old and perhaps she was going to get it wrong. But it told of God standing at the edge of the universe with the wind blowing in his beard, saying, this has always been a troublesome star, I shall destroy it. And the voice speaks, Father, I am still here. And God replies, my son, I thought you were dead. I've been trying to speak of Jung's work in a way which allows for movement between father and son, and for prophecy. Prophecy of what is to come as fulfillment of what has already been done. And I've said that I hope to leave us with a lively sense of unfinished business with the number 3. I expect many of you have noticed that I've said nothing of the missing 4th. Or the missing feminine, ideas which are central to Jung's essay on the Trinity. The omission has been deliberate. I've tried to speak across Jung's argument about the quaternity in order to sound a note of urgency about time and about the need to bring together social and mystical experience of the body. Because what matters is that there be movement between father and son, between creation and incarnation. To dwell with that movement, we need first to shiver those naturalistic assumptions which make it appear as if the Trinity were masculine preserved. I've tried to speak of such a shivering, an excluding, which is also including, and a confessing, which is also claiming. My hope, as I've already said, is to leave you with a lively sense of unfinished business for the number three.
Well, David, thank you very, very much. I think there's quite a lot to absorb and digest there. May I say that the hope that I've had over the past, this fourth session of lectures, that we should come upon the feminine side of God, is realized, as it were, by a hair's whisker at the very last moment. You've put a lot of ideas into my mind. You talked about time, and I wondered about space. I think perhaps we're talking in models here, but in the different traditions, we've got the appearance or the movement or the activity of the spirit coming in terms of both without and within and amongst. And there is this question not only of extroversion and introversion, which obviously is absolutely crucial to it, but also of immanence and transcendence in the spirit. And I wondered how you felt that related to the movement that you see in the Trinity, as opposed to something from beyond as well as something in the midst.
I think in what I was saying on extroversion and introversion, I was trying to reach out to the idea of the creation of space.
Yes.
And I think with that and also the idea of the creation of time, it's easy things to say, but I think they're extraordinarily difficult to imagine, really. And that I think if one can just reach the stage of realizing or beginning to realize how difficult it is to imagine what one might mean by the phrase the creation of space or time, then one's got as far as one can reasonably expect. And I was trying to indicate how I think this extroversion, introversion language and this, all these metaphors of insides and outsides which psychoanalysts and sociologists, anthropologists use so often in discussing individuals and groups. How very mysterious it is, to be sure, just what one means by this distinction. It seems clear to begin with, yet certainly when I move my hands towards myself like this and say it's inside, I'm not really locating it inside the skin of my body. But trying to say something, I believe, in the inside-outside metaphors in all their variety, which is going behind it to the mystery of the creation of space and how body is related to space.
Mm. You see, I was thinking when Jung talks in his psychological types of the difference between the Zwinglian, the Lutheran, and the Catholic position on the sacraments in terms of transubstantiation, in terms of consubstantiation, in terms of the sign. We're asking the theologians to both demythologize and remythologize a mystery which has always had a very transcendent dimension. And therefore, one wonders how subjective one can be, and yet to talk their language and come to terms with it.
So what I would like to see happening is more movement between that sort of concern and the extraordinarily intense language of interiors and exteriors spoken, for instance, in some of the psychoanalytic schools,
yeah,
in which the distinction between inside and outside of the body is literally being made to carry a weight which I think belongs elsewhere.
Could you elaborate on the notion of death as inventive?
I don't think I can, no. It was the effect when I was reading the Jacob of that invention. Who invents, as it were? Who invents? It was as if it became suddenly clear that in the middle of a language in which he was speaking of a natural process in which any idea of creation or of an inventor intervening was excluded, all of a sudden this word invention in relation to these two words, death and sexuality. And I'm still wondering now. The sort of effect of wondering on myself and in my work is to start me asking, are some of the intimations, usually in dreams, which I believe are about death, can one begin to relate to them in a sense that allows them to be inventive? Inventive of what is now, of where one is now.
Your concepts of the two concepts of time, historical time and biological time, taken in relation to this myth of Uranus pushing the children back into the womb and this cyclic oscillation of time, how would you say that that tied in with the individual's approach to God?
Well, I think the time I came closest to realizing I was speaking into that theme was when I began to realize that my rather, in the way I do with language, the word assumption was beginning to carry a certain weight that I ought to acknowledge, where I say an assumption is being made which is not and can never be reasonable, if by reasonable we mean natural, but it is reasonable if we are willing to invoke an authority which is over nature. And I realized that I had in mind the doctrine of the virgin birth and all the ways of understanding sexuality, which I think any attempt to take that doctrine seriously draw into our field of reflection. But I don't think, tuned as I am now, I can really speak directly into what you're asking. I don't know if anybody else feels that sort of more with that than I am. Yes, I wonder if it isn't in fact much more often thought of by simple folk, as it were, but it's the erring and the assertion and knowing how to relate it up to the dominant views of time and space in which we live, which is where we falter. And I think one thing I'm sort of hoping to encourage by talks such as this is that simple folk and all of us in our simplicity should have more confidence in noting how our behavior and our bodies may be being experienced in some way creative of time and of space, not only happening in them. You know, for instance, in trying to stay with over months and years, if need be, with the feeling that there's some connection between whatever one means by honor and dishonor, and inside and outside. Staying with that until somewhere, from somewhere, one is given a link, an idea that enables one to say, yes, I was right, to be obstinately convinced that somehow it wasn't just a matter of extroversion, introversion, or something like that, but that my sense that it involved honor while saying something.
Well, David, I think the depth of which you've spoken, with a sense of vision in which some people have tapped one part of it, some people have tapped another, and has moved round the room as I've seen it, somehow it's akin to a movement of the spirit that I've not really come across before. I've felt the spirit dance, I've felt the spirit grip, but the way it has placed itself here and there in our minds is bringing a synthesis in which the spiritual presence is created, and we thank you very, very much.